Today's teshel will be case 70 in the Book of Serenity. Jinshan asks about nature. Introduction. One who hears the scent-bearing elephant crossing the river has already gone with the flow. Even one who knows that birth is unborn is stayed by birth. If you go on talking about before concentration and after concentration, making bamboo shoots and making rope, you will be marketing the boat when the sword is long gone already. Kicking the wheel of potential into motion, how can you particularly travel on one road? Let's try to bring this up. Case. Master Jinshan asked Master Zhuishan, clearly knowing the unborn nature of life, why are we stayed by life? Zhuishan said, bamboo shoots will eventually become bamboo, but if you use them now for bamboo rope, you can make them serve. Can you make them serve your purpose? Jinshan said, later on, you'll be enlightened on your own. Zhuishan said, I am just this way. What is your meaning? Jinshan said, this is the monastery superintendent's quarters. That is the cook's quarters. Zhuishan then bowed. Verse, empty and at ease without dependence, lofty and serene, untrammeled. Home and country peaceful. Those who arrive are rare. A little bit of powder divides ranks and grades. The fluid, clear mind and body is beyond right and wrong. Right and wrong ended. Standing alone on earth, there is no beaten track. Let me begin by saying how happy I am and how grateful I am that all of you have been able to make it to this session. I consider myself to have quite good karma, that you all have made it here and are coming to practice this beautiful path of Zen. I watched you come in last night. And I have to tell you the truth, my heart was just, up in the sky. I just felt so wonderful. I know that many of you have very busy lives and demanding schedules. Some of you probably had to run out of your offices to get here. And when you go back, there'll be a mountain of work. Some of you have given up income to be here. And others have had to make other kinds of personal sacrifices. So I understand what it takes to be here. I understand your commitment, and it's just wonderful. It was just wonderful to sit here with you this morning in this beautiful Zen mind. On this beautiful summer day, and I'm just so happy you can make it and we can all be here and walk this path together. Very precious. As I was saying the other day, we really can't control anything in our lives. We can accept how we respond to events, I should say. But the events themselves are flowing along like a river. And there's really very little we can do sometimes to control what's going to happen next. So we can't really know where we'll be in even 6 months. We all have to make plans. We all have to make plans. And we spend a lot of our lives planning and then worrying when our plans don't come to fruition. Or when they come to fruition, worrying about their going off the rails. But the truth is that it's often the case that we just don't know. I understand that our whole society is built on what's called, you know, rational planning. And it is amazing, you know, we can put a spaceship into space, and you can build a part of the ship in Russia and part of the ship in the United States, and when they dock they can fit together with you know, less than a millimeter of error. Probably that would be too much error. I don't even know what I'm talking about, but that would be too much error. So there's a lot of planning, right? They could build something, put it up in space, you know. So you think, well, you know, that's planning. It works. But on the other hand, you know, really and truly, none of us can say, well, where we will be in 6 months. Some of you have had the opportunity to read, I think it's called Pure Heart, Enlightened Mind. If you haven't had the chance to read it, I invite you to read it. It's really a wonderful book. It was out of print for a little while, but it's back in print now. And some of you have read it, I know. But it's about a young woman from New England who was actually an Irish immigrant. And she went to college, and she wasn't a so-called spiritual person or something like that. And as fate would have it, she wound up in Japan and began to sit with Roshi there, Soto, Tsaotong Roshi, named Go Roshi. And she was, you know, remarkably free from ideas about what should happen in her practice. She just started practicing. She sort of got in it sideways without thinking about it and started practicing. And she made extraordinary progress. She had her Great Awakening experience after 1 year of Zen practice. Now, let me just say, I myself have never met anybody who fit that category. I've known a number of people who have cultivated awakened mind in a very profound way. And I would say that both of my teachers were people who spent large portions of their lives in awakened mind. But they had to work very hard to wake up. And most people do. I mean, remember, even the Buddha had to work for 6 years before he had his Great Awakening. So this was this person, Maureen O'Halloran was her name, was really quite amazing. And her teacher was pleasantly surprised and amazed. And in the back of his mind, he said, this is going to be the next... this person is going to be the next Joshu, or the next Weinang. You know, this is going to be somebody who is going to, you know, make the mountains shake with her insight. And you know, she was just a very diligent practitioner. One time, Go Roshi said, "Listen, I want you to just stay up all night and sit." And she wasn't the kind of person who said, gee, what will, I myself am the kind of person who would, you know, hear that and say, stay up all night, but I'll be tired, you know. And boy, my legs will probably really hurt in the morning, you know. And then I'll think about where I could go wrong and all of this stuff. But she was the kind of person who just said, okay, and did it, you know. For some reason, she had her Great Awakening after 1 year. And Go Roshi was thinking, this is going to be the next Wei Nang, the next Mahakashapa. You know. And anyway, he was preparing her future career, and she went to Thailand to take a vacation. In Japan, monks and nuns are able to take a vacation during certain months of the year, and they can go home. This is probably done in China now, but in classical Chinese Buddhism, this was never done. And in Theravada, this is never done. I mean, basically, like in Theravada, you don't go home. You can see your family, but you can't go home for vacation. And in Japan, even sometimes monks will take off their robes and go to a baseball game on their vacation. But that would be, in classical Buddhism, you'd be expelled from the Sangha for that. Chinese Buddhism was closer to that Theravada in that way. But in Japanese Buddhism, there is like a vacation period. And people can go home, like school, like summer vacation from the monasteries. And you can see your family and friends, and go, you can go to Hawaii if you want. So anyway, Maureen O'Halloran went to Thailand. She had always wanted to see Thailand, and she was in Thailand, she was having a good time, and she was walking down the street, and she stepped off a curb, and a bus hit her and killed her. Go Roshi was a very deeply awakened person. So, when he heard about this, he was asked about it, he didn't, cry and say, he understood something more, and he said, well, maybe I'll run into her again. But the point is, you can't really predict where you're going to be in 6 months. And, very few people probably wind up doing, or many people, I think, probably don't wind up doing what they originally set out to do. My teacher, Kangan, my second teacher, Kangan Roshi, was like in childhood, he was a child prodigy on the piano. He was adopted by parents who had been like missionaries. They were Christian missionaries. And they adopted him, and they wanted to raise him with every advantage. And one of the things they wanted to do was give him the opportunity to develop musical talents. And he was educated by very good teachers in Oklahoma. That's where his father lived and mother. And basically, he became an incredibly good pianist. And he was being groomed to be like this star, like this Glenn Gould type person, if you know classical piano. And he went out on the concert tour when he was very young. And the pressure just, crushed him, basically. And, I don't know if he had like a nervous collapse or something like that. It doesn't sound like Glenn, but like Kangan, but somehow it just didn't end well. And years later, at the end of a session, before we had our own place, we used to rent a place where there was a piano. And I remember one day we were wrapping up the session, we were getting ready to leave, and we were walking by the room where the piano was kept, and this music flowed out of the room, this beautiful classical music. It was like, huh? Better than any recording. It was just amazing. And we looked inside, and there was Glenn a kangan playing the piano, just burning through this beautiful music. But, you know, he didn't become a classical musician. He wanted to be, as he got older, he got interested in art history and decided he was going to be an art historian, which is how he made his living for a long time. And he went to Japan to research a famous painting, Japanese painting, called Five Persimmons. And it's a very famous Zen painting of just five persimmons. And they express the persimmonness of persimmons with the greatest simplicity. There's no color. They're just, you know, black ink on white paper, as I recall. And there's these five persimmons. And there may be a little color now that I think about it, but very simple. And he went to this temple where, which I believe was Myoshinji, I'm not sure. And he wanted to look at the, it might have been Kankoji, I really don't remember. But at any rate, he was at a temple in Japan where these were, the temple owned this painting. And the abbot said, if you want to see the painting, I'm afraid you're going to have to do zazen. Because you won't be able to see it unless you can do zazen. Otherwise, it'll just be a bunch of theoretical nonsense. So Glenn started doing a zazen and had a very hard time. You have to ask yourself what makes people do the things they do. You know, there's something inside us which is so amazing. You know, there's you could say the master. You know, there's something inside us which is so amazing. We say true nature. You know, we're running around with our heads chopped off like a chicken, running around like a chicken with our heads chopped off, right? Worried about this and that, this and that. And yet all this time, there's something which is like the universe unfolding inside of us. They're giving us instructions and a voice like thunder, you know. So anyway, my beloved teacher, went to this temple to study art. The Roshi said, you're going to have to do zazen. Dzogchen. And so Webb started sitting, and it was incredibly hard for him. He doesn't like to talk about it, but his wife told me that he actually used to faint. In Japan, if you are training to be a monk, you can't, and I don't think this is a good idea, by the way, because it's not uwe, it's not natural. But in Japan, the style of training is that if you want to be a monk, you have to be like 100% all the time. And so it's like full lotus all the time. And the Jikki Jitsu will walk around, and if you're not in full lotus, you know, basically he'll pull you into full lotus. Right? And I don't know how that actually works, but somehow it's like, it must be very strong. Yeah. But it's like you're either going to sit full lotus or you're out of here, that kind of thing. So Kangan, Glenn, would sit full lotus, and it would be so painful for him that sometimes he would throw up, and sometimes he would pass out. And I did ask him. I said, "What did you do when you threw up?" And they said, "Well, they just made me clean. You know, they'd hand him the bucket and stuff. And here you go, clean it up." And I said, "What did you do when you passed out?" I said, "They'd wake him up and put him back on the cushion." So this is crazy, right? You know. But for some reason, he didn't leave. You know, that's the most amazing thing, right? And you think, see, I'm out of here. This is a madhouse, you know. But that's, you know, there's like the small mind says, you know, this, oh gee. This is crazy, this is nuts. And the big mind says, you know, this is your path. So the person who became Kangan, Webb, kept practicing for years and years and years, very hard. And for some reason he didn't quit. And he finished his formal training in Japan. And then he and his teacher went to China. After the war, his teacher was critical of the war effort in Japan. His Miyauchi Kenko was like a war objector, objected to the war, which is quite unusual. Here in this country too, critics of the war are not in the majority usually. But after the war, he and his new Dharma heir, Kangan, Miyauchi Kenko and Kangan, went to Hanshansu and were received there by the abbot. Webb came back to the United States having made great progress and having been ordained and having had many Kensho experiences, but not Dai Kensho. And he started a sitting group in Seattle while working as a professor of art history at the University of Washington, which is where I met him many years later. But he had his Dai Kensho at a sesshin that we were holding up in our temple, which is Tokuganji. We had just built this zendo and a kitchen and so on. And we were having a beautiful summer sesshin up there, and that's where he had his Dai Kensho. So you just never know. You just never know. It's so precious that all of us can sit together here in this beautiful way. And we have no idea what the future holds. Could get hit by a bus. Could, you know, we just don't know. And yet, knowing this, you know, makes every moment extremely precious and beautiful, especially with people you care about, and people who have, I think people who sit together like this have really like deep-rooted relationship. My feeling is that there's a kind of intimacy or kind of rootedness, connectedness, that's very unusual. I have to say that I love the people in my family a lot, but my deepest relationships are with my people I've known in the Zen world. And it's a kind of thing that's like under the surface, you know, just these deep connections, the deep connections. But when I first met my teacher, Genki Roshi, I couldn't sleep. Now, he wasn't like me, you know. Genki Roshi was a really good Zen teacher. He was like, he was just amazing, you know. He was a thoroughly accomplished person. And I showed Jaru some of his calligraphy. I sent her some calligraphy, and indeed it was magnificent. I was poking around online, and I was trying to find Genki Roshi's tea bowl outlet. He makes tea bowls, beautiful. And he has an online store where you can buy some of his ceramics. And the site was down, but I found instead this calligraphy that he had done. Somebody had taken a photo of it, and it just blew me away. I just thought, if that isn't, that's Genki for you. And I'm just stunning. And he could do that, you know, he was just a thoroughly, he had, by the time I, Genki Roshi had sat more when I met him than I have sat now. So, you know, he was just like, he's where I want to be, and we'll try very hard to be. But anyway, when I first met him, I just couldn't even sleep. I was just so excited. I have no idea why, you know, but it was just this somehow some part of myself said, you know, you really need to walk this road. So anyway, I can't know. I guess I should get to the koan. So, well, it seemed so complicated when I read it. You know, that koan was so complicated. Very difficult to make sense of the koans in the Book of Serenity. I was debating about whether or not to read this koan or another one from the Blue Rock Collection, the Blue Cliff Record. There's a simple koan in the Blue Rock Collection where Master Joshu says something like this. He says, you know, clay Buddhas can't survive water. Bronze Buddhas can't survive fire. And bronze Buddhas can't survive, I don't remember, wooden Buddhas can't survive fire. And the point is that all the Buddhas, whether they're made out of wood or bronze or clay, are going to dissolve and disappear. See, everything is going to go. And that makes this moment very precious, really, really precious. So that's part of what this koan in the Book of Serenity is also talking about. It's like, you know, when we come to Sesshin, usually on the first day of Sesshin, we're in usual consciousness. And ordinary consciousness is like thinking about the past and thinking about the future. It's in the past and the future. It has, memories, and it has dreams and aspirations for the world to come. And it's it worries because it thinks about the future, right? And it hopes and it dreams and so on and so on. And it worries because things are not necessarily going to go the way we plan. And when you come to Sesshin, all of that stuff is right there, you know. Maybe something happened to you a few days ago and you're still worried about it or troubled or your heart is heavy. Or, you know, maybe something this year didn't go the way you planned, you had some disappointments or tragedies. Or, you know, that you may be entering a period of uncertainty in your life. None of this is unreal, you know. This is ordinary consciousness. But when we come to sit and do a sesshin, this beautiful, precious practice, I just can't tell you how much I love it. When we come here, you know, we sit on the cushion and sit on the cushion and sit on the cushion. And little by little, our consciousness undergoes some kind of fundamental change. It may only be a little change at first, but eventually it's a deeper change. You know, we stop holding on to the past and we stop projecting into the future. And the mind is able to stay in the moment and just be in the moment just as it is, you know, just as it is. And this is very, you know, you'd think this is the simplest thing in the world. You know, you would think this is the simplest thing. What's the big deal about that? You know, if you went home and somebody said, did you go to a Zen retreat? You said, oh yes. And they said, what did you learn at the Zen retreat? And you said, I learned my ears are on the side of my head and my nose is in the front. Right? They'd think, you guys are a bunch of idiots. You know? Doesn't everybody know that? But it's so hard just to experience the moment as it actually is. It takes days of practice. And not just days of practice, years of practice. Right? And it's so hard to be in the moment because we have expectations about the past, and we have memories from the past and expectations about the future. So, you know, if you came here to practice Zen, you may have, or if this is your first time at Sesshin, you may have had a very different image, say, of Sesshin. You know, you might have thought that you were going to go down some road and be in a remote place, you know, very far from humans. You might have thought that this was going to be very, you know, like a Japanese or Chinese building, shoji screens. You know, I have sat in such places, you know. And maybe you thought the floors would be made out of oak or bamboo, you know. And this is a very ordinary place. It's in a busy beach, you know, community in South Central New Jersey. It's a bustling little town. It's not maybe what you expected. And you sit on the cushion and, you know, maybe you were expecting beautiful sounds of the breeze, you know, but instead it's a dump truck or garbage trucks emptying the dumpsters. You know, and beep, 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 beep,
boom.
You know, and you can say, I didn't sign up for this shit, you know. This is not my beautiful Zen world, right? At that moment, because in that moment, you create a kind of barrier, right? Because you want one thing to happen, and then something else happens, which is not what you want. And instantly, tension arises. And the tension, it goes all the way down to your toes, really, you know? Tension is, we come here, by the way, with a lot of tension. And we carry a lot of tension in our bodies, unconsciously. And when you sit on the cushion, you know, if things don't go your way, you can get very tense. And that can include, you know, maybe you imagine you're going to sit on the cushion and have no discomfort. And when you feel a little pain in your body, that can cause you to tense up too, you know, which actually makes things a little worse. But, you know, we have an image of what's supposed to happen, and then when the real thing happens, you know, we can say no, and we can have all kinds of emotions, disappointment, anger, and so on. It's very hard just to be in the moment and go with the flow. And go with the flow is such a cliche, right? And when people think about, you know, they think of Zen, maybe they think, oh yes, very touchy-feely, go with the flow. Oh yeah, you go, you know, what could be easier again? But no, very difficult for humans to go with the flow. It's very difficult for humans to practice wu-wei. To try, but don't try. It's very difficult to let the moment present itself just as it is. And it's because we're afraid the moment's going to hurt us or disappoint us. And it might if we have expectations. I mentioned yesterday's Teisho, somebody came in on the first day of Sesshin to Dokusan. By the way, a few days ago we had the Memorial Day here in town, and this is like a motorcycle city. People in Lenoka Harbor, every person owns a motorcycle, a giant Harley Davidson, which they didn't think made enough noise, so they've adjusted it to make even more noise. And on Memorial Day, everybody has to go down Route 9, I think it is, and go through all the gears in a few seconds. You know. And so, we're sitting in the Zendo, and it sounded outside like the movie Road Warrior, if you've ever seen Road Warrior. But you may not have, because that was 30 years ago, so my pop culture references are kind of old. But the thing is, it would be possible to say, oh, this is no good. No, this is just terrible. But somebody came into the Dokusan room and said, the sound of those motorcycles and sirens is really helping me to sit. And I didn't want to give the person the wrong impression, but I wanted to give him a big kiss right on the forehead. I didn't do it. But I was so happy, because that's really being in the moment, right? I mean, nobody's too troubled when you hear birds chattering outside, singing birds, because you're supposed to be in nature, you're supposed to hear birds. Now this morning you might have noticed that there was a bird argument going on. Did you notice? It was between a crow and a grackle. And they were having like a bitter argument outside our window. And a crow is about 5 times bigger than a grackle. But the grackle was standing his ground and the crow was screaming at him. And if we understood their language, it wouldn't have been a pleasant thing to listen to. But even that you could say, well, some people would complain and say, oh, those damn birds, they're so noisy. I want my... Zen is not about silence or quiet. See, it's a big mistake to think what we're trying to achieve is like, we're trying to get to someplace that's totally quiet. See, because that actually creates violence. That actually creates resistance to the moment. What we're trying to do is to unify ourselves with the energy of the universe. Whatever form it takes is okay. See, and whatever form it takes is the form it's taking right now. So sometimes, indeed, it's soundless. And sometimes it's a garbage truck emptying a dumpster. And if we discriminate, we create tension. But if we practice wu-wei, if we practice natural presence in the moment, suddenly beautiful. It's just it's only our arbitrary distinctions that says this is a natural sound and this is an unnatural sound. Now, if you could listen to the birds, they're all saying, "Get out of my way! Get out of my way! Who are you? Who do you think you are? Really? Get away! Get away! I'll kill you!" Right? They're aggressive. Birds are territorial. They're either that or they're saying, "I'm over here, beautiful. Come on over. Come on. I'm powerful. I'm rich, And we're saying, "Ah, the birds. How sweet." And they're saying, "I'll kill you. I'll kill you. Come on over. Have you ever seen wings like these? Boy, I'm really something, But, when they say that, it's also the voice of Buddha. It's the beautiful. It just takes us a little work, to get to the point where we can take the moment as it comes and be present in the moment. And we sit on the cushion and we watch our breath and we straighten our back and we pull the mind back to the breath or back to mu over and over again. And little by little, we begin to have a real simplicity of mind, really beautiful simplicity of mind. And in that moment, everything is Buddha. No birth and no death. And so, you know, you may have only a few moments like that at the whole session. If you have a none this time, keep going. It's very precious achievement. And if you have even one little second of it, you should feel very good, because that's like a little second of heaven, a little second of enlightenment. So this koan, very complicated koan, is really just about being in the moment, right? Just being present in the moment. It's very, very metaphysical. Master Jinshan asked Master Zhuishan, we know that the universe is formless, so why are we here in form? Why do we get trapped by form? And we know everything's Buddha, so how come we're so unhappy? How come we're so fearful? How come we're so angry, whatever, disappointed? And all of this is just a mumbo jumbo, really. Behind it all is just the simplicity of the moment, which is what the koan wants us to discover. And with his acumen, great penetrating insight, Master Joshu puts it so simply. You know, everything comes and goes. If you hold on, you're going to be miserable. And if you try to stop things from coming and going, you try to keep the moment from arising, you're going to be miserable. You know, so the proper way to greet the moment is by being in deep mushin. And practically speaking, what that means is, you know, if it's noisy outside, go deep into mushin. That person who came in and said that the sirens and the motorcycles are helping you to sit really had it. You know, it's like when it's noisy, you have to become quiet. The noisier it is outside, the quieter you can become inside. That's one way to put it. You know, and when you discover that this is possible, this, you don't have to be, it's like some people, they suddenly realize, I don't have to follow my thoughts, right? Most people are like the prisoners of thought. They think a thought and they go along with the thought, and it produces all these emotions, all this anxiety. And if you keep coming back to the moment long enough, you suddenly realize, you know, I don't have to follow these stupid thoughts, and I certainly don't have to have these emotions. I can just be in the moment. You know, just watch the thoughts come and go and not be made their prisoner. You know, and it's the same thing with everything. You know, you can have that kind of freedom. You know, as things arise, they don't have to produce conditioned responses, right? Which is just the culture and karma. We have all these conditioned responses. I like this, I don't like that. But with this cultivation of a mind of emptiness, you know, the events that occur no longer have this conditioned character, and they're just pure presence. And in that state, everything is quite wonderful. Coming and going is quite wonderful. So this is, for most people here, this is day one of the session, and what I'm talking about is probably in the future. It's going to take a day or two to begin to have a little taste of this. Everybody got off to a wonderful start this morning. We had a magnificent morning. The sit was wonderful. And everybody's doing a wonderful job. So now, you know, we're all on this road together. We don't know what the future holds. We don't know how long we'll be on this earth. You know, if anybody wins the lottery after you leave here, you know, please remember the session as a positive experience. But whatever happens, this moment is really infinitely precious. And let's taste that. Let's experience that together.